interview with Les Cox at head office, 26th of September 1996. Well, let's close the door. Alright, Les, thanks for agreeing to be.
No problem.
Recorded on tape.
I'm surprised anybody would want to know, but there you are.
Yeah, it's just that for the project I'd like to go over what we talked about in the backyard when we had the party out there.
Right.
Basically, if you could start with your personal background, a few personal details, family background, how you came to be interested in socialism and your attitude to the wars that capitalism seems inevitably to throw up.
Right.
We've got plenty of time, so...
Well, I was born into a fairly happy but poor family. My father was very militaristic, ultra conservative, a bit sycophantic, a bit snobbish, although he had no grounds to be, because he was when I was born, he was a messenger at what was called the War Office then, which was an honest name for that department. It's now called the Ministry of Defence, which is not so honest. However, his military career started as a boarder at a military school, Duke of York's military school. At the age of 8, I believe, my mother said. It's very young to learn how to kill people, but there you are, they did start young then. I mean... he was the son of a military man who was with his wife and older two children stationed in India. So they couldn't drag a 7 or 8 year old boy around, or girl. And in those days, the military ran these schools for the children of members of the armed forces who were serving abroad if they were too young. And that's how my dad started his military career, at the age of 7 or 8. And then he was a boy soldier in the Boer War, 1899-1901, as a bugler boy. I think he must have been about 13 or 14 then. But as he kept stressing, they all carried rifles. And he was proud of that he was really a soldier, even though he was only 13 or 14. So the Boer War came to an end. He didn't get injured in the Boer War, and the experiences did nothing to change his mind. So he was a regular soldier when the First World War broke out, and he was sent overseas in the First World War. So how old would he be then? From 13... 1901, 1914, so add on, so he'd be 24,
early
20s. Yeah. So then he got through the First World War without being killed, but he had a bullet went through the muscle of his arms, so he couldn't fire a rifle properly. So they invalided him out, which was lucky for him, because I mean, if he'd have been capable of still firing a rifle, I wouldn't probably be here, and neither would my brothers and sisters, because he would have been killed.
When you say he went overseas, you mean other than France, did he?
France and Belgium.
Oh, yeah.
Only Europe, the European First World War, the Western Front, you know, all that.
Yeah.
And so then along comes the Second World War, and the first thing he does is to volunteer for anything, air raid warden, fire, auxiliary fire service, anything to serve his country and king, as it was then. So, which he did, and he was out in all the air raids with a tin hat on, and as people probably know, when there was a heavy air raid on, the anti-aircraft guns were firing thousands of shells, and the shrapnel from the shells used to rain down. You could hear it raining on the roof and hitting the road and if you were out, there was always lots of people got killed with shrapnel hitting them on the head or what have you. So he got away with that as well. So anyway, But he wasn't a bad old cove. And then during the First World War, the Second World War, when I was about 13 or 14, I was evacuated out of about 22 miles out of London, down in Surrey. And somehow or other, being sort of away from the family and not being constantly enveloped in the spirit of war and what you might call a militaristic approach, I began to talk to other children of my own age from different parts of London. And in particular, there was, by pure coincidence, there was a school that had been evacuated from the East End of London, the majority of whose pupils were Jewish. And strangely enough, although it became, with the benefit of hindsight, a war to release Jewish people from the concentration camps and the discovery of all the bodies, but nobody knew about that then. And strangely enough, although everybody was anti-fascist and everybody was anti-Hitler and everybody wanted an Allied victory, but a couple of these Jewish boys of my own age had parents who were communists, you see? And so their attitude was slightly different. Yes, perhaps we do have to defeat fascism, but it's not really about that. That's only incidental. And they were well, no, that's unfair to them, because they weren't just mimicking their parents. They amazed me by... I mean, I was a snotty-nosed, ignorant sod then, you know. I mean, very naive and totally unpolitical and religious. I used to go to church regularly, and I used to serve at the altar in a high Anglican church, which is like Roman Catholic, only the services were in English.
Was it compulsory, was it?
No, I went to a church school in London, St. Barnabas School, and everybody naturally went to the church, you know, and you served in the choir. My brother and I both sang in the choir and served in the church. So I'm evacuated, and I'm amongst an entirely different sort of set of young people who had different experiences and different upbringing, because there was a homogeneity about the upbringing that all the friends I knew in London. I mean, we all went to the same school. All their parents were poorly educated, very poor, held down menial jobs, and all thinking alike in a sense. About Hitler and the war, and all pro the monarchy and the king, and all backing everything the British government did, and very, very deferential to ministers, you know, the government, very deferential, as my old man was. And then I got evacuated, and getting different attitudes and conversations.
Well, what area of London were you evacuated from, Liz?
Pimlico, which is just on the edge of Westminster. And, it comes into the borough of Westminster. And so, to cut a long story short, they started me thinking. First of all, I made a friend of a particular Jewish lad who, much to my astonishment, took no part in the special days and events put aside for the Jewish children. Passover, he didn't want anything to do with it. Yom Kippur, no, he wasn't eating matzos and gefilte fish or whatever. He wasn't going to the... Because they used to bring some... Actually, she was a woman. She wasn't a rabbi, but she, like, indoctrinated. She happened to live nearby, and she was very, very Orthodox Jewish. So she kind of helped these children to say their prayers in Hebrew, and as Jewish children should, in quotes. But this lad, Ezra, his name was Ezra something or other. I've forgotten his surname now. But Ezra, he said, no, I'm not religious. What? I'm saying? How can you not? What do you mean you don't believe in God? Oh, shock, horror. Because we've all been brought up believing God. I mean, and later on, for a Jewish boy to be saying all this, it became, anyway, so we started arguing, naturally, and then others joined in. It made me start to think. He started putting, you see, the process of squeezing out myths, old wrong ideas, wrong attitudes, and absorbing new ones, you've got to squeeze out the old ones first to make room. That's sort of the way I look at it. It's like a sponge. You've got to squeeze. Somebody's got to have the ability, the knowledge, the confidence, and the persuasive power to squeeze out the old ideas, to leave room for you, bit by bit, over a period of time, after due consideration, to start absorbing new ideas. And this is what happened. And he used to sneer at me, not in a nasty, because we were friends. But he used to sneer. He said, "You've never read a bloody book in your life." I said, "I have. I've read The Mystery of the Five Guinea Watch." He said, "They're all romances." I said, "I've read Robinson Crusoe." He said, "That's all make-believe. I mean, you haven't read anything about the world around, you know, you haven't, have you?" And he started saying, "You're Dickens." He started me off reading Dickens.
How old would you have been then? It's like this, right?
Well, he would be 14. I would be coming on for 14, about 13. So that's what started me off thinking about religion and the war and everything else. When I came back to London, I must cut this short because it would be going on for hours. When I came back to London, I started to think about lots of things that my dad had got wrong, or rather that there was another side to the question of the way we are and the way we think and what people do and their attitudes. And I started to go to different meetings. And I ended up joining the Young Communist League because I saw, I think they used to hold street meetings in Pimlico near the street market. And I was up, I used to go up there shopping, and I listened to some of their meetings, and I got interested. And a lot of what they said tallied with what I was beginning to think myself, in a very simple, naive way. I mean, I wasn't by any means knowledgeable enough to make judgments or anything, but it seemed right. What they were saying seemed right, which was anti-war. It's an imperialist war, they were saying. It's nothing to do with the working class. It's a war between two imperial powers who want to grab the world for themselves and to make money out of it and to exploit. They're arguing about who should have the right to exploit Africans and Indians and all the rest of it. And that seemed right to me because, you know, I could see there was a lot of that going on. So I joined the Young Communist League. And later on, as many people know, there came the double Volta Face, where, if that's the right pronunciation, about face, where one minute it's an imperialist war. Oh no, first of all, before the Ribbentrop-Molotov peace pact between Nazi Germany and Russia, it was, if I've got it right, you'll have to check your history, I should know all this, it was a just war against the Nazis and fascism. Because Russia was against, although Germany hadn't yet invaded Russia, remember, but the Communist Party and, of course, the Young Communist League, who did everything they were told by the leaders, the elders of the Communist Party. I mean, the Young Communist League had no autonomy of its own. It did and spoke and printed everything it was told by the head office at King Street, Covent Garden, and directives would be sent down. So it was a just war, it was against fascism, and working class should support it. Then the Russia and Germany entered a pact, a non-aggression pact, the Ribbentrop-Molotov non-aggression pact. And it was Stalin's new policy to be friendly to the Germans, to, you know, or to at least not call them names. No name calling. So the directive comes down overnight from King Street. It's not a just war against fascism. It's an imperialist war that workers should have nothing to do with. And blah, blah, and all the propaganda. Right. Well, that seemed all right. You know, we weren't thinking very much for ourselves. Next minute, well, it seemed in a short time, not the panzer divisions attack Russia. Wow, so that non-aggression pact was just to permit the Nazi forces to build up on the borders secretly and then to launch a panzer attack against the poor Russians. Shouldn't laugh, because millions died in that attack. I mean, they just slaughtered one village after another. It was terrible. But anyway, but from the Communist Party and the Young Communist League point of view, this was quite something to grasp. Anyway, it didn't take them long, I would say about 3 days, before it then now became a just war again against fascism and for the establishment of democracy, which they claimed people had in Russia, workers. And workers should tighten their belts, work hard, not demand higher wages. They were against all trade union activity which hindered the war effort, because Stalin had said, we don't want any hindering of the war effort, because, you know, we want to defeat the enemy. So Stalin sends a message to King Street, make all the British workers work hard, because then they can send the surplus armaments and food and or whatever to help me out, says Stalin. So now we've all got to work hard, pull our belts in, not demand higher wages, blah, blah, blah. And even, I can remember in, what was it called? The Challenger, I think, was the Young Communist League newspaper. And I can remember articles saying, in order to defeat this Nazi oppression and threat to the well-being of the people of the world, blah, 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 you should volunteer to work 4 extra hours per week. It might have been 6 extra hours per week. Unpaid. This is from the Communist Party, who's on the side of the workers. But all because the situation had changed. And what's more, their printing press must have been on a very high alert, or they must have been very skilled, because the next, after the attack by the Nazis on Russia, the next branch meeting, a week later, there were already posters up showing the Nazis as Hunnish animals bayoneting nuns. You know, the cliche pictures. There were pictures of showing German soldiers as horrible monsters with grim, death-like faces, with their bayonets out, and bodies. I mean, I'm not saying the people that were lying on the ground to be bayoneted actually were nuns, but it was in that style of posters, and we were supposed to go around putting these up. And in all the Communist Party branches and Young Communist League branches, these posters were ordered to be put up. And there are others with a lot of text on them saying, you know, how important it was for the socialist revolution to defeat the Nazis and all that, because and the motherland, they always referred to Russia as the motherland, our motherland Russia, must win, because that's the only way we can guarantee the social, they still called it the socialist revolution. So that was okay by me, but I was a little bit, all of it, I could take on board the horror of the Nazis, and I could take on board the fact that people were suffering horribly and all that, and somehow or other it had to be stopped. But what I couldn't take on board was the fact that they could change their position so fundamentally overnight. That left me a little bit uneasy.
What about other CP members? Was there a questioning in
the... Well, though I didn't have the courage, but others did. I can remember slightly older members of the Young... I was about... By this time, I must have been about 15 or 16. No, 15, not... About 15. And so they... older members of the YCL in the branch meetings did ask questions. But they were quickly slapped down. You weren't supposed to question policy. Policy and tactics, strategy and tactics were, policy, strategy and tactics were part, given out as orders. I mean, we all, you know, you had to accept that. You were allowed to ask questions provided they weren't too difficult. One woman in particular called Tamara Rust, who was the guru, like the mentor of young Communist League branches, she would go around from branch to branch. She was, I think she was half Russian, so probably a KGB spy for all I know as well. But anyway, she used to go around from branch to branch giving us pep talks and laying down the law on what we must do and what. And it was at one of these meetings where some older members of the YCL asked some pointed questions about how can it change from being blah, 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 blah. And she said there are reasons, a bit like the excuse that that priests and parsons give, there are reasons why we have to do this that are not for us to discuss, not for us to consider. Take it, you have to take it on trust. You will see in due course that there are very good reasons why we did what we did and why we said what we said. So we were supposed to take this on trust. In other words, Stalin moves in a mysterious way his
wonders to perform.
Yeah, how's it
his wonders to
his
perform.
Wonders to perform. So that was the Tamara Rust theorist she was, but also a propagandist. And it was anyway, so I began to ease myself away from the YCL three or four times. Oh, I forgot to mention, by this time I'd run away from school because the age of I had previously run away from school because the age then, the school leaving age was 14, but I came back from the hill where we were evacuated, which was Cooper's Hill, just outside Egham in Surrey, just past Staines, if anybody wants to know. You could see the Blitz on London. You could see all the shells exploding in the sky, and you could see all the flashes of the bombs falling, in particular the shells exploding, because they were like little like fireworks. And when the Blitz was really bad, you could act. Sometimes, if the wind was blowing in towards you, you could actually hear the explosions of some of the larger bombs. Because, as you know, sound travels sort of up, and the wind picks it up. And on one or two occasions, air mines must have gone off or something. You could actually hear a very faint thump. So, cut a long story short, I thought, well, a bugger this. I'd rather be with my family. I don't want to stand here watching the ship being knocked out of my family and friends in Pimlico and me left on my own. So I at 13 and a half, I'd already returned to London. So I got a job as a butcher's boy and things like that, which was very handy because our family then began to live like royalty on more meat than we could consume. Because there was very severe rationing, Mr. Baldwin, the butcher, he used to at the end of the, you know, a couple of times a week, he would bung a few scraps, as he called them, in a carrier bag, and you know, my mum made hay with those, and we lived well while I was a butcher's boy, but it didn't last because, like most socialists, or to be socialists, or people who have it in them to be so bloody contradictory, argumentative, and questioning, and unable to submit to any kind of oppression, which is what I suppose begins to make somebody think about socialism. I was already a bit of a rebel, and I had a row with his missus, who was the boss in the shop, about something, delivering two loads to a restaurant or something, and getting it mixed up or something. And I'm insisting that it was her fault, and she's saying, how dare you talk to me like that? And I must have said something like, not piss off, because I don't think that expression was around then, but I must have said something like, stuff it, which was probably more appropriate for the 1940s, and left that and got another job. Right, so later, so this is going on, so I'm looking for another job, and my brother Sid had already, my brother Sid was an electrician and had been sent around the place doing different jobs, and he met up, strangely enough, for some reason which I don't know, a lot of tradesmen, particularly skilled tradesmen like electricians and carpenters, were socialists. By a lot, I don't mean the majority, but I mean on many building sites or large contracts, you'd find a few who were either members of the Socialist Party or knew a lot about them. And my brother Sid had gotten a conversation with these people, and he was very influenced, and he had either joined the Socialist Party or the SPGB, or was about to. And this is at the same time that I'm relinquishing the Young Communist League attachment because of feeling uneasy and starting to question. So I then began to go to Socialist Party meetings, in particular Speaker's Corner and places like that, and branch meetings and lectures and debates, and I was very impressed. Who wouldn't be? I mean, they were of a very high standard, and even I could, I mean, I had no proper education. I mean, I left school a bit of a dunce, really, to be honest, and but I mean, even I could realise there was a lot of thought, there was a depth of analysis which you didn't get, that wasn't happening anywhere else, in any other party or organisation. And it impressed me. And particularly when, instead of saying, when I ask silly questions, well, not silly questions, but questions that everybody ought to know the answer to, or instead of sneering and saying, you ignorant bastard, why don't you go and, you know, get some unintelligent sod or something like that. Instead of that, they were saying, well, the brief answer is so-and-so, but it wouldn't, I think you'd find this book quite interesting because it answers a lot of what you're querying, and they would recommend a book to read or whatever.
And what kinds of books?
Yeah, economics. The first book that was recommended to me was Robert Tressel's The Ragged Trousers Philanthropist. I was absolutely staggered when I read that. I mean, and the war is still going on, and I'm beginning, my eyes are beginning to open to all sorts of things. Like, the rest of the world is stood still in a, like a trench, firing at each other. But here, there's all sorts of things going on about the future, about the past, history, how important it is to understand how things work and what makes the system tick, and who are the bosses, why is it that, you know, there's rich and poor and all that. And another question, and every time I would ask, they'd say, well, there's a debate or there's a meeting, you know.
Okay.
Right. So party members were very helpful and encouraging, and I began to attend meetings and listen to debates and lectures and outdoor meetings and all that. And the war was coming towards an end. By this, I was pretty convinced that the Socialist Party was for me round about the age of 18, getting on for 19. This was in the spring of 1945. And 1945, you know, D-Day and all that was afoot. And much to my surprise, I was called up for national service. Well, I shouldn't have been surprised because they were calling people up. I think I was 18 when I first got notice of when I got my call-up papers. By this time, I was convinced that I didn't want anything to do with it and that it was what the war was about, what the Socialist Party said it was about. So, to cut a long story short, I asked around, what do I do to object? Because I'd heard that you could be registered as a conscientious objector. And somebody put me in touch with Tony Turner, who had steered members of the SPGB through this process on a number of occasions, and he gave me good advice. Remember, I'm still not a member of the SPGB. I still hadn't made up my mind about joining, but I more and more began to appreciate that there was a lot to be said for it. So when I met Tony Turner, I asked him, should I join the SPGB so as to be able to say that I want to be a conscientious objector because I'm in the Socialist Party? And he said no, because members of the tribunal who are going to try you might think that you've only joined the Socialist Party as a device in order to persuade them that you're a true conscientious objector. It's better if you appeal independently. But you can use our political stance, our political analysis, as your reasons for wanting to be a conscientious objector, which I did, and he helped me to word it, make it simple. It's the same advice that you give to young people today, very often. Make it straight, make it simple, make it to the point, make it brief. That must have come quite hard for me, actually. But anyway, I lodged an appeal. I must have been sort of 18 and three quarters. By the May of 1945, I got the papers to fill in to go before the tribunal. Sometime in June, I went before the tribunal. I read out they'd already got copies of my statement, but you had to read it out. Then they ask a lot of questions. And in particular, one of the members, who I believe was a bloke called W. Tudor Davies, who was a trade unionist, because on these tribunals they pretended to have a cross section of people to judge your appeal. Always a magistrate was in charge. In this case, it was His Honour Judge Sir G.P. Hargreaves. Then the trade union district secretary or something, quite a big noise in the trade union. I can't remember which trade union, but quite a big noise in the trade union. I think he was on the TUC. And the other bloke was a Professor Picard, Cambridge, with about half a dozen letters after his name. Or was it A.B. Swales, who was the trade unionist? Do you know, I can't remember. It could have been A.B. Swales, because I've got the names in front of me, or it could have been Tudor David. Anyway, he was a right bastard. He was the one that asked all the rotten questions. He was the one who wanted to persuade me to go and fight in the armed forces. The trade unionist on the side of the workers, defending workers' rights and democracy and all that. He was a right nasty bastard. And he was the one who, I suppose, they worked a system like the hard copper and the gentle soft copper. He was the hard copper, asking all the awkward questions, and the others tried to trick me with more gentle approach. And he would ask the questions like, if you saw your sister about to be raped, what would you do? And I'd say I would defend her, and if necessary, I'd shoot the bastard. But that's got nothing to do with waging war, what you do personally. So I'm not a pacifist, and things like that. So anyway, it seemed to go down all right, and Tony Turner has actually accompanied me, as he accompanied many other applicants, which was very good of him, because He must have been a very busy man at that time. He worked 24 hours a bloody day for the party, speaking and writing and giving talks and God knows what. Anyway, he attended and he made a statement, which is here in front of me. But
I've got a copy.
You don't want me to read this out now, no. So after a couple of weeks, they wrote and said, yes, you are registered as a conscientious objector, but you are still subject to the Direction of Labour Act, which meant that although you were relieved from joining the armed forces, you had to do work of national importance. So I had to write back and tell them what work I was doing at the moment and what work I would prefer to do, or you know what options I would choose for being directed into labour of national importance. So when I told them I was a carpenter working on bomb damage repair for government buildings, on government buildings that had been damaged by bomb damage, which was partly true to a certain extent, they snapped at that and I was directed to continue doing what I was doing in effect, which was fine by me. And of course the war was coming to an end in 1945, that's how I got registered. Now this is 1945, but it was another 2.5 years before I joined the party. I joined the party in October 1948. Let's see, that's 48 years ago. That's 50 years. Come 1998, that would be 50 years. I'll have to do something to celebrate that. Anyway, I will be 70 years old in 2 weeks' time. And that 50 years in the party has been, of inestimable value to me. And I could speak a lot about that. From a snotty-nosed ignoramus to a snotty-nosed ignoramus with pretensions. Now, what else do you want to know?
When you went before the tribunal, were there other people?
Oh yes. There was a Quaker with three elders of the Quaker Church standing by him, and when he was called forward, they accompanied him, stood each side of him. His Honour Judge Hargreaves said, "Only the applicant shall come forward. You remain in your seats." And they said, "No, we won't. We will stand by him and hold his hands, because we are his brothers. He is our brother. We support him all the way. We won't interfere with your questioning and your his answers, but we will stand by him, which is what we've sworn to do." When we say stand by him, we mean literally to stand by him, and they had to allow it. Normally, you had to go forward to a little desk where you could rest your papers, and you're on your own. And there were members of the public could attend, but they were in the hall, like, and you went up to the dais, the platform.
So this wasn't a pucker court. This was just a...
No, this was in Fulham. Actually, took place in Fulham Town Hall, in the small hall of Fulham Town Hall, and there were lots and lots of conscientious objector tribunals. The tribunal sat for lots and lots of cases. In fact, I think for the whole of West London, it was the Fulham Town Hall, and there were members of the public there. And all sorts. So there was this this Quaker, I remember, was directed to join the armed forces in a non-combatant role. So he didn't get off very lightly, although he probably didn't mind that, you know, in the ambulance brigade or stretcher bearer or something like that.
If that had been the option offered you, Les, would you have taken
No, because I would have thought that that was too. I mean, I know work of national importance. People had to go down mines, work on the land, COs, or work in hospitals. Now, I forgot to mention, my brother had his tribunal sometime before me, and he was directed to work in hospitals. Why I don't know. I'll have to ask him. He probably has explained to me, but why he should have been directed to work in hospitals. So he found himself working as an operating theatre orderly in the Brompton Hospital in Fulham Road. It was an experience, and it's better than having to go on the run because your appeal was turned down and you were sent to the armed forces, as many party members did. But the other chap who was refused registration, I remember, registration as a conscientious objector, was a young man who his defence, his statement and defence was in the form of poems. He read out poetry and he said, "I'm on a higher plane," and things like that. And this is not a matter that concerns people like myself who understand, you know, the things on a higher... A little bit mystical. He was a mystic.
Yeah.
Bang, armed forces. He got his bleeding khaki uniform on, sharpish, poor sod. It was sad, really. But much to my surprise, our case seemed to impress. In fact, His Honour Judge Hargreaves said to Tony Turner, "Oh, this is another one of your acolytes, is it?" And Tony said, "Yes." "Oh," he said, "is he going to come out with the same stuff that all the others have?" And Tony said, "Well, to a greater or less extent, yes." Oh, well, that practically convinced Hargreaves, because, I mean, he must have been intelligent. His Honour Judge Sir G.P. Hargreaves must have been intelligent enough to understand that a reasoned, principled, well analysed, holistic case that the Socialist Party had was something that took a lot of undermining. You know, I think it impressed him at least. So, okay. A couple of years later, I joined the Socialist Party in October 1948.
What?
So it took me all that, even though I was so impressed, it took me all that time from first contact with the party in late 43, 44, my brother already joining, me going to meetings, reading like I've never read before, absorbing all the stuff, but still it took me another 2.5-3 years to convince myself.
The party was doing outdoor platform meetings.
Yes.
Because in the first war they gave it up, didn't they?
That's right. Well, they did carry on outdoor meetings in all the old established places, but they had to be careful what they said. I'm not quite sure of the law, the act, what it is, but it's something to do with causing disaffection to the crown and the state. And you had to be... You couldn't encourage people to refuse to join up, for instance, that you'd be arrested. And there were very, very frequently policemen standing by, listening. I mean, not standing by idly by out of curiosity like they might do today, or at Speaker's Corner to prevent knife fights. They were there to report you if you said anything, any made any statement which could be construed as against the war effort, or encouraging people not to join up, or encouraging people not to work to their best ability for the war effort. So often speakers would start off the meeting by saying, "Now, I'm not here to discourage you or to prevent you joining up if you want to, or working hard in an armaments factory or anything like that. You must do that if you feel that is right, because, you know, that is your prerogative," and all that. All we're saying is, and blah, 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 blah. So, like, they would cover themselves right from the beginning, so that the policeman wouldn't get his notebook out.
What was the general attitude of the public to the party case at this time, Les? Was it sympathetic? Was it oppositional? Was it a bit of both?
Sometimes it was very violently oppositional, especially those who had sons, relatives in the armed forces that had been killed or maimed or what have you. as I had. I mean, I haven't mentioned the fact that my two brothers, one, Jack, was evacuated from Dunkirk in a state of shell shock and suffered subsequently quite a lot. My other half-brother, my mother's son by her first husband, who himself was killed in the trenches in the First World War. She had two children by her first husband. Her first husband gets slaughtered in the trenches in the First World War. Her second husband, our dad, who was the air raid warden in the last war and also in France in the First World War but came home, he survived, but my natural brother Jack and my half-brother Charles both suffered in the war. Charles was taken as a prisoner of war in Singapore at the fall of Singapore by the Japanese and served 3.5 years as a prisoner of war being worked to death. But fortunately, although he was a very skinny chap and you wouldn't think he was robust enough to endure a 5-mile walk, let alone 3.5 years working like a slave for the Japanese. He didn't work on the Burma Railway, but he worked in equally horrendous places with people dropping down dead all around him. He survived that. And I'm aware of what he must be suffering. Yeah. A mum posting off a dozen of these Red Cross postcards where you're allowed 6 words in the hope that one might get through to him if the Red Cross happened to be part.